This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon we talk with the man who leaked a 7,000-page multi-volume secret government study on American foreign policy in Vietnam to the New York Times and then the Washington Post and other newspapers. The documents came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. Their publication in 1971 altered U.S. history. Daniel Ellsberg is our guest. He's now written a memoir about the Pentagon Papers, the title Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. In the wake of the publication of the Pentagon Papers came a landmark ruling from the Supreme Court, Ellsberg's arrest and trial, Watergate. The publication of the Pentagon Papers ultimately helped end Richard Nixon's presidency and the war in Vietnam. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for Daniel Ellsberg. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. After graduating from Harvard University, Daniel Ellsberg served in the Marine Corps for 2 years. Then he returned to Harvard to earn a doctorate in economics. In 1959, he joined the Rand Corporation. Then in 1964, he was recruited to serve in the Pentagon under Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Following 2 years in Vietnam for the State Department, he returned to Rand. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Daniel Ellsberg, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm happy to have the opportunity. Thank you.
Sure. Some listeners may be too young to know much about the Pentagon Papers, so I thought I would ask you right here at the top to give us a sense of the information this study of American foreign policy in Vietnam, the information that it contained.
Well, it had 4,000 pages of documents, mostly top secret from the period, Joint Chiefs estimates, analyses by the civilian parts of the Defense Department and elsewhere in the government, memos, directives by the president, all of which had been, which was history by the time the Pentagon Papers came out in 71, and even in the newspapers, and even history by the time that I gave them to the Senate earlier in 1969. The study ended in 1968, so it didn't deal directly at all with the Nixon administration. But it did deal with four previous administrations, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, two Democratic and three Democratic and one Republican. And demonstrated really a tremendous gap between what the public had been told in each of those administrations about what the government was doing in Vietnam, what its intentions were, what its aims were, and what the programs really were at the moment, what had been done and what was being done. A great gap between what the public was told and what these documents indicated insiders understood of what they were doing, what the costs would be, and the estimates. One thing revealed, for example, was that there really was never any great optimism at all in the government that almost any of our policies would have long-term success or even short-term success in preventing a victory by the communist-led forces that had evicted the French from the northern part of Vietnam, North Vietnam, by 1954. They also revealed that Eisenhower at that time had no intention of allowing the elections which were promised in the Geneva Accords that ended that conflict with the French. A conflict, by the way, which the papers showed had been financed by the United States predominantly since 1949 and 50. That in the Democrats' anxiousness, and followed by the Republicans, not to be accused of having been in office while Vietnam went entirely communist, as communist China had gone in 1949-50, and to be accused with the notion they'd lost Vietnam, they really, administration after administration, was prepared to sacrifice an indefinite number of lives, both American and foreign, to postpone that result. The result was virtually inevitable, finally, because of the prestige and the experience and the support that the communist-led independence forces had achieved by their successful fight against the French. And what the papers showed was that presidents understood that pretty well. It was just a question of whether they could put off that result by fighting it, by escalating the fighting, until they were out of office, which was an aim that, in the eyes of most Americans, would not have justified any killing at all. And certainly the level of warfare that was being conducted. But the administrations could not admit that that was their real aim to the public, so they gave false impressions that the cost would be low, that the success was just around the corner, there was light at the end of the tunnel, and so forth, all of which were known really by the officials to be false. There was a pattern of governmental lying went right through both Democratic and Republican administrations, right until the war ended under President Ford.
Mm. You went to Congress first with the Pentagon Papers. You went to William Fulbright.
In 1969, I copied this. I felt that I'd been wrong to conceal these lies and the realities behind them from the Congress when I was first in the Pentagon in 64, 65 as a full-time employee. And in 69, 4 years later, after 4 years of war, I felt that the war was going to get bigger and was not only going to continue, as I say, but was going to get bigger, and that it was way past time for Congress to understand how they'd been manipulated all this time. So I copied the papers and gave them to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Senator Fulbright with the expectation that he encouraged that there would be hearings using these documents, and they would call witnesses and get the history out, and I hoped make the public realize that the same pattern was being reproduced under a fifth president, under President Nixon, although I didn't have documents to prove that, but that the long pattern of deception would at least make it plausible that a fifth president was doing the same. Fulbright chose not to bring the documents out. He felt there was too much support for President Nixon's, again, quite false impression that he was giving, that he was getting us out of Vietnam, and that Fulbright would appear to be interfering with that in some way by holding hearings and bringing them out. So he didn't do that, and after two more invasions, really, war in Cambodia in 1970 and Laos in 1971, heading toward new escalation in North Vietnam, I gave the documents to the New York Times, and when they began publishing in June 1971, President Nixon issued an injunction, got an injunction from a court against them to stop publishing, the first injunction against the press in our whole history. I then gave them to the Washington Post, which published them and was also enjoined, then to the Boston Globe, which was enjoined, and ultimately to 17 other newspapers, of which one other was enjoined, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But in the end of that, after several weeks of this process, with the newspapers defying the Attorney General and the President as to whether these historical documents would hurt the national security, the Supreme Court ruled against the injunctions that a sufficient case had not been made for such a prior restraint. So publication was resumed, but I was put on trial facing charges of a possible 115 years in prison for copying the documents. It was the first such prosecution ever done in this country against someone for a leak, for an unauthorized disclosure. And the person who had helped me copy the papers initially, Tony Russo, was also put on trial.
Hmm. Why were there no hearings after publication of the Pentagon Papers?
That's a very good question, which I've been asking myself a lot as I was writing this book and reliving the history. One thing I became aware of was when the papers first came out, when I was underground with my wife, still getting them out from one paper to another with the help of friends and strangers who were trying to help end the war. I hadn't fully realized in that process, till I was restudying it, that both Senator Fulbright, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, said, "We will have immediate hearings and we will use these documents and move on." Another thing I didn't know, which came out only this last year with new tapes from President Nixon, was that he agreed he wanted hearings, and he wanted them for the reason, ultimately, that they didn't want them. namely that they implicated the Democrats at least as much as the Republicans, if not more, in recent years. They made them look bad, and the party simply didn't want to go into history that for it constituted dirty laundry. President Nixon did want those, despite the fact that they raised the plausibility that his own administration was doing the same. And the next question is why he didn't get the hearings despite that. Apparently, I think it was essentially that the Democrats backed off, despite Nixon's desire to see them.
Yeah, and then Nixon...
I wanted to see them, too. In that respect, I was allied with Nixon. As a matter of fact, one of the tapes shows, our best ally is Daniel Ellsberg. He's going around the country saying, why aren't there hearings, and why aren't people looking at these things? And so we were on the same side of that issue.
Well, you were on the same side for a little while. But then the Nixon White House, you know, worked to discredit you.
Yes, but that wasn't because of the Pentagon Papers. I say we really were on the side of getting history out, since the history was largely, from his point of view, was largely Democratic history. That wasn't my concern. It was history. It was our country's history. And although I was a Democrat, I was prepared to see that dirty linen out. He was afraid, with some basis, realistic basis, that I had documents on his own administration that went beyond the Pentagon Papers. And I did, as he knew, but I didn't have as much as he feared or suspected. I wish I had, but I didn't have what proved what I was saying, that he had made nuclear threats. In fact, I wasn't saying that at the time. I was saying that later. But I was saying that he had threatened massive escalation, which did come about. Indeed, a year after the Pentagon Papers, he was bombing North Vietnam very, very heavily, leading up to the heaviest bombing in history, after an election that year, just after, in which his assistant for national security, Henry Kissinger, had announced peace is at hand. And people voted for that, happily. And then we saw the heaviest bombing in human history for several weeks over Hanoi. He was afraid that I had documents that would prove what he was planning to do and what he was threatening, and he had to shut me up. And although I didn't have such documents, it was quite plausible and realistic for him to fear that I did. And I think he reacted as I'm afraid many presidents would have reacted. He acted illegally to silence me. He sent people to get information on me from my former psychoanalyst's office that might blackmail me into silence. The point wasn't to release it immediately, but to threaten me with releasing it if I kept denouncing his policies. Then later, some of these same people were sent to beat me up or intimidate me on the steps of the Capitol in 1972, May 3rd. And then they didn't carry that out because they were afraid they would be captured. But just weeks later, these same people were caught in the Watergate. They then had information about White House crimes against me and some others to tell the prosecutors if they weren't shut up. So President Nixon then undertook further criminal activity of bribing them into silence, to perjuring themselves. And when some of that began to come out then, thanks to John Dean revealing it to prosecutors, mm-hmm. and he revealed the break-in to the psychiatrist's office, the president was now on a path that led him to resignation, facing impeachment. And that did make the war endable. So because of President Nixon's reaction, his criminal reaction, to not so much to my immediate revelation, but to his fears that there would be further revelations, my actions did in fact contribute to ending the war, which was good, although it was very belated.
Yeah. We're talking this afternoon with Daniel Ellsberg. He has written a memoir, Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, the title, Secrets. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers ready to talk with us. We're going to go first to a caller on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. It's an honor to ask you a question, sir. I want to go back a little bit in the history of French Indochina. And is it not true that Ho Chi Minh was actually our ally against the Japanese? And to
Is that correct?
Spur him on, we promised freedom for Indochina from the French. And then
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing this too well. Could you speak?
Oh, okay. Isn't it true that Ho Chi Minh was actually a U.S. ally against the Japanese?
Yes, that is true.
And that we had promised him that colonialism would end. We reneged on that.
No, I would say that no promises were made to him. The people who worked directly with him, including an OSS major named Archimedes Patty, found himself quite sympathetic to Ho Chi Minh's fight for independence, but he was in no position to make any promises and did not, as far as I know.
Nor
did Truman, in matter of fact, or FDR at that time. In fact, FDR was very unsympathetic, Franklin Roosevelt was unsympathetic to French colonialism, but for reasons of our diplomacy in Europe, where we relied on French against the communists and to counterbalance the Germans to some extent, he did decide, somewhat reluctantly, but he did decide to back France's effort to regain its colony. That was a really rather fatal error for the next 30 years, and it was persisted in by Truman.
Oh, so we did not promise him.
We did not. No, we didn't make a promise, and we didn't renege on the promise. We did act in very strong contradiction to our own country's tradition of self-determination and of opposing colonialism. We ourselves, of course, had liberated ourselves from an empire. And we'd made promises of a very general sort in the Atlantic Charter that our aims in the war was for self-determination. But since Churchill joined us in that promise, Churchill did not clearly have in mind letting go of his own Britain's colonies in India and elsewhere. And that was another reason for our backing the French effort. We felt that if we did not back a French effort to reconquer a colony that had declared itself independent, and both in March of 45 and in September of 45, that the British would take that as a very unfriendly precedent for their own colonies in India and Malaya and elsewhere, and we were very close to the British. So for reasons that did not really do credit to our anti-colonial tradition, were in contradiction to it, we supported these post-war colonial efforts.
And when did Ho become communist?
Ho had been a communist since very early in the communist movement, around 1920, I would say. He founded the Indochinese Communist Party in the early 30s, I think 1930. But that came after independent nationalist efforts by him. He actually turned up at Versailles with a borrowed frock coat and whatnot for a diplomat, to argue for his country's independence in the light of Wilson's 14 points, promising self-determination. Of course, they had a very good case for it, but Wilson refused to see him. And it was after his disillusionment, I think, at Versailles and with other efforts in France that he joined the communists in what he saw was an anti-colonialist struggle.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to say you're a very courageous man, and we all owe you a great debt. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to another listener, a caller on the toll-free line calling us this afternoon from Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's also an honor to speak to you, Dr. Ellsberg. I heard you on Book TV this weekend on C-SPAN, and then you were on, I guess you had been on a WGN radio interview program, and what I got from that is the one of the great lessons from this is that leaders lie, and especially on your C-SPAN talk, you were seeming to predict that by the time or after the election, after the Republicans had won, in which they seemed to have won a majority, that the war with Iraq would be in full force. But do you still hold true?
I made the prediction the Republicans would win. I must say I was...
You didn't predict that, but you said after...
...pointed last night. Yeah. But I thought that whoever won, whoever won, and I don't think I made a prediction, though I favored, I certainly was, as I say, disappointed that the Republicans got control of the Senate, because I think that makes war even closer than it was. I thought that even if the Democrats had controlled the Senate, and remember, as I've said on some of these programs, in my view,
the majority
of the Democrats had covered themselves with shame by signing over their constitutional powers on this own war to the president. So I was very disappointed in the president, in the Democrats, too. But even had they won, I think they would not have done what they could and should have done to stand in the president's way. He clearly does believe this war is in the interests of the United States as well as those of, I don't know, his close allies in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And he wants this war, and at this point, I did foresee that his starting the war would be accompanied, and I do foresee that, not with certainty, but with high likelihood, that will be accompanied by the kind of deception and manipulation that we saw in the past under my Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think the president will claim at the last moment that he has evidence, which at most I would say would be very ambiguous evidence, but that he will claim he has unambiguous evidence that American forces are being put in danger, and as commander-in-chief, he has no alternative but to move fast against Iraq to protect American forces. And I think this is very likely to be untrue or unfounded, I'm calling on people in the government who know that to be the case, if it is the case, who know that their president is once again lying or manipulating the country into a wrongful and unnecessary war, that they should do what I wish I had done back in 1964, go to Congress and the press immediately with documents and tell the truth.
Do you see any evidence that has begun to take place?
Yes. In fact, there is much more unauthorized disclosure, which is the official term for leaking, than we ever saw in Vietnam, one could say, except for the Pentagon Papers, and that had to do with history, mm-hmm. with past events. We're seeing now current documents being released by people, mostly anonymously, but also very many statements of belief and understanding by people like Major General Anthony Zinni, who's just given as a matter of opinion, but a very, very informed opinion. He was previous head of U.S. forces in the Middle East and was Bush Jr.'s own representative as a mediator in the Middle East. And he was saying that he does not see Saddam as anywhere near the number one danger to the United States and sees no real or justification for invading him at this time, or any link with al-Qaeda. Others are saying the same. The current director of CIA, George Tenet, has made an unclassified statement, which he was clearly legally authorized to do, but I am certain not authorized, not encouraged by the president to do, to Congress, directly contradicting what the president had just been saying to Congress. Namely, Tenet said CIA has no evidence of a link between no credible evidence of a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda or any evidence or any reason to predict that he would give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists in the absence of a U.S. attack. And on the other hand, he said that he felt that if we did attack, there was a high expectation that he would give such weapons to terrorists and would use them himself to possibly terrible effect. He didn't add this, but I would say that that meant a high likelihood that we or the Israelis would use nuclear weapons, which would be a precedent.
Thank you very much.
Would danger us. So people are speaking out more than before, and when I add my encouragement to that, it's just I think we can use a lot more of that.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon and invite others to join us. Daniel Ellsberg, our guest here on the Afternoon Magazine. The numbers to call if you'd like to join us with a question, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to August of 1964. Mm-hmm. You were new at the Pentagon. You had been working with the Pentagon as an employee of RAND, but in August 1964, at this point, you had been recruited to work for the Pentagon. August 1964, you're not there very long, and the Tonkin Gulf resolution is passed.
The first day,
yeah.
As a full-time employee, the alleged attack on our second attack on our destroyer in the Tonkin Gulf. It was taking place in the morning that I joined the office. And by the time our raids had taken place that night, the very first night, Washington time, the first raids against North Vietnam that were to continue for over 7 years, the president had made statements that I already knew to be false, that there had been, there was unequivocal evidence of an unprovoked attack on our destroyers in routine patrol in international waters, and that we had retaliated with the intention of no wider war. And there's about five assertions there. I knew within days, and mostly that very first night, that each of those assertions was false and known to be false by the president, that, he was lying and the country was being lied into a war, first via a Tonkin Gulf resolution that gave the president unlimited power, really, to respond as he saw fit, as the president determined, to attacks on U.S. interests abroad, a very broad delegation, which he used, of course, to get us into a major war.
And also, very quickly, you became acclimated to the culture of secrecy.
Well, I was that already. People have asked me, wasn't I shocked by all these lies my very first night? And I had to say, well, no, I'd been a consultant for years and was aware of lying. Though it was true that once inside, I didn't learn a whole new dimension of that.
Mm-hmm.
There was far more lying than I had realized. By the way, as the previous questioner pointed out, they've heard me speak about lying. I'm not really talking about lying as being the problem. The lying is far more pervasive than I think any outsider can imagine. But my complaint is ultimately not even so much with the lying. As I said, I was kind of used to that as a consultant, but with what the lying encouraged the president to do, which was to follow a policy for which he could not have gotten adequate support if it had been open, but a policy that was essentially crazy, extremely against U.S. interests, disproportionate to any U.S. interests, and with very great dangers. I believe that's happening right now. And even though there is more disclosure than there was then, a great deal of lying is going on. And again, my complaint is with lying to a degree, but much more with what the lying is about, the secrecy and the effective lying, the plausible, the fact that he gets away with it, enables him to carry out a policy that seems to me, as it does clearly to many members of the administration beneath the president, essentially crazy. That it's a reckless gamble. That is not justified at all in its dangers or in the people that it will kill. We're about to kill and Middle Easterners, not only Iraqis, I would say, and Americans, in a cause that does not in any way justify those deaths.
Hmm. Tell us what you learned, though, working for John McNaughton, and tell us about his ability with reporters to feed them a line of bull.
Well, my boss, John McNaughton, I think was not unusual in that respect. At that job, dealing with reporters, and I didn't personally have to deal with reporters, you have to be an effective con man, effectively, essentially, to have the job. It's just part of the job. It turns out that that's fairly widely held, that capability to fool reporters from a position of authority. As I've said to my close friend Cy Hirsch, who's the perhaps the number one investigative reporter in the country, known as very hard-bitten, made very many exposés, which have gotten him two Pulitzer Prizes. I said, Cy, I don't believe that you can imagine how often, that you have any idea how often you still in your life are lied to and how effectively, how much you are fooled by it. Because that's the way the government works. They regard that as part of their job. It's not that they're unusual liars or necessarily even unusually good liars. It turns out that speaking from authority with supposed lots of information behind you, reporters, like other citizens, want to believe that they're not being lied to. They want to believe their president is telling the truth. And the president has an enormous advantage when it comes to fooling people. But the moral of that, it seems to me, is twofold. That, one, that they are following policies that are vulnerable to truth-telling. So if you believe they're wrong and dangerous in the government, and I'm sure the government is filled right now with people who believe the current course of action is dangerous and wrong. The very leaks that are happening indicate that, and we're getting leaks about dissent within the government. They do have a power to change those policies by telling the truth. Not by doing something wrong, but by doing something right. They have more power than they really may think of themselves as having. And from the public's point of view, we can demand that of our officials and get some of it. But we can also, this is the positive side, the real moral is you don't take your understanding of the situation, you should not, mainly or only from what you hear from officials or from the president, whether it's a man of your own party or not. You've got to supplement that with news from other sources and test that against each other in your own common sense and form your own opinions on this. There's no substitute for doing your own investigation on these very important matters of life and death. It's worth the effort, and it is possible to do. It's somewhat easier than it used to be with the Internet now, because you can see editorials and comments from all over the nation in a site like, for example, www.antiwar.com or commondreams, one word, .org, and they bring you information from all over the world, really, which it was much harder to get 30 years ago.
When you were working in the Pentagon back in 1964, your new employee, and pretty much you're pretty quickly brought up to speed, were you thinking about the welfare of the nation? Did you think about the public, or were you thinking about John McNaughton?
Well, it isn't quite an either-or there. Certainly, I felt quite idealistic as a public servant and earlier as a Marine, that I was doing this for the good of my country and for the good of the people and for the world, and that what was good for the U.S. was good for the world, and what was that we were all working, and I'm sure that's true today, by the way, that people do see themselves, whether I agree with their judgment or not at all, I have fully confident that they see themselves as working for the good of the country and of people and of the world. But there is a strong tendency in any line of work like that, I think it's not only the government, to have your sense of what's good for the world shaped very strongly by what's good for your team, your organization, your corporation, your boss, and thus ultimately your own job and your career. If you see the good of the world as being opposed to what's good for your job or what's good for you, you're in a terrible dilemma often. But most people don't see that. They manage to see what they're doing is quite compatible with the good of the world, and so they sort of focus on what their boss wants, what certainly if you work for the government, what the president wants, and that you can't go wrong in terms of your own career by doing it that way. It's rarely a good career move to be going against the interests of your boss. So there's a very strong tendency to see everything as converging in that way, even when an outsider can see what seems to be a very obvious contradiction.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we're going to go to a caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm wondering what you think or thought of the United States military response and attack on the Al-Qaeda organization in Afghanistan. Was that well justified? Were we lied to? On the face of it, it seemed like we were responding to attack the people who attacked us on 9/11.
Yes.
I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
First of all, it's very clear, increasingly clear, that we really do face a serious danger from Al-Qaeda. And we didn't have anything corresponding to that at the time of Vietnam or even in between. This is new, and it is a very serious danger, along with other dangers in the world we could name, like the danger of nuclear war anywhere, which is a precedent, as in India-Pakistan, which is a kind of precedent that endangers the whole world, including us, the dangers of toxic warming, the dangers of toxicity. These are general dangers which are very real. And in addition to those, we have a significant danger here. If we took that list of dangers in the world, facing the world, and facing the U.S. specifically, I'd put al-Qaeda very high in that list, if not the most immediate of all. And along with another one, by the way, the danger of, which is related, the danger of leakage, so to speak, of nuclear weapons and materials from Russia, where they're ill-guarded, and where I'm afraid, thanks to our own policies and thanks to al-Qaeda, the black market price of a Russian nuclear weapon is probably going up, 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 and up. So the chance of al-Qaeda getting a nuclear weapon from Russia or from Pakistan, for example, is, I think, very serious danger to this country and elsewhere, much, much more than the danger of their ever getting weapons from Saddam, or nuclear weapons, if he ever gets them, from Saddam, unless he is attacked. To come right back to al-Qaeda, I think it really is a danger, as far as I know, not linked to Saddam, as far as the CIA knows. And when it comes to Afghanistan, it was quickly clear that they had a real base in Afghanistan, which, so that to attack Afghanistan might or might not have been a prudent or effective thing to do, but it was addressed to a real problem. It had a real plausible base there. You were attacking the home base and the funding base at the moment. Oh, well, I'll take that back. The real funding base is in Saudi Arabia and in Pakistan. It wasn't coming from Afghanistan. But the money was going to Afghanistan, and you were attacking their home base. Now, there's nothing like that realism in attacking Iraq. When we attack Iraq, we are not attacking al-Qaeda. We're making al-Qaeda's problems almost surely easier. Their problems. We're making our problems harder by making new recruits for al-Qaeda and by making it harder for other countries with a large Muslim population to cooperate with us against al-Qaeda. So it's good for al-Qaeda. I would assume that Osama, assuming he's alive somewhere, is praying for the U.S. to attack Iraq. And that's pretty obvious in a way. The attack at Iraq is against the interests of our struggle against al-Qaeda. And going back, was it a good thing to attack Afghanistan after all? The word is still out on that. George Tenet of the CIA has just warned us that we're in greater danger now than we were before 9/11 from al-Qaeda. Well, that shows that the attack on Afghanistan certainly did not solve the problem. On the face, it would seem to have made it worse. One could argue, well, maybe it would be even worse if we hadn't attacked Afghanistan. I'm not a good judge of that. My own guess from what I've read is that it did not forward our interests very greatly, although it had some plausibility as a way to attack it. Given that we were unable to get Osama or most of the al-Qaeda people, given that they went into Pakistan, given that their funding seems, if anything, to have increased, and that they're still at it, an actual military attack did not seem to have served our purposes very well. And I think there is a general point to be made from that. This is a serious problem, and it is not a problem with a military solution on the whole. If there was one place where a military approach had some plausibility of helping, it was Afghanistan. It may or may not have helped there. But elsewhere, it's a police problem, an intelligence problem, and it absolutely demands cooperation from all the places where al-Qaeda operates, and that means Muslim countries, but it also means countries like Germany and elsewhere where they have operated. We have to have cooperation, and if the U.S. acts in an illegal, reckless, arrogant, and lethal way that enrages the populations of these countries where we need cooperation, we will find it harder to get that cooperation, and our problem will be more serious. And I'm afraid that's exactly what's on the way.
Thank you very much. It's nice to hear you speaking.
Thank you.
Let's talk with another listener on line two, caller in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've just finished reading an article in Newsweek regarding the military buildup in the Gulf. On a scale from 1 to 10, although you've just commented on it, on the dangers of it, what do you think are the chances of some kind of military action against Iraq?
Well, I've been asking my friends who are more wired in on this than I am here in California for my own, you know, to get a sense of that. And the most optimistic answer I've gotten from someone who is quite well wired in is that there's a 1/3 chance of no war. In other words, 2/3 chance of war. These kinds of estimates are I'm comfortable with because I worked for a long time on the question of expressing uncertainties in terms of odds. It doesn't mean an objective probability, but it means, you know, what is, in your own opinion, do you think the odds are? And other friends put it much higher than that, close to certain, or being certain. Well, nothing's certain, quite certain. Miracles do happen, such as the fall of the Berlin Wall or the peaceful resolution in South Africa, which virtually no one foresaw. And maybe there will be no war. I would regard that as a kind of almost at this point, after the election even, as much of a miracle as those, but they did happen. I think the hope now, I was putting more hope in Congress, somehow getting in the way of this yesterday or 2 days ago, and trying to think of ways to get Congress to live up to its responsibilities and at the very least demand that there be no action without UN sanction. Whether he gets the UN sanction is not yet clear or not.
You think the chances of that now are pretty
strong? I feel that Bush is determined on regime change here, which will require invasion. And my current hope, as of midnight last night, and now, okay, if Congress is going to be part of the problem here, what can possibly avert this? Because I think it's extremely important that it be averted, not only to save a lot of lives, but to avert reactions by Saddam that will be suicidal on his part and terribly murderous, weapons of mass destruction, which could lead to the use of weapons of mass destruction by us or the Israelis. I would like to see at this point, and if you know any way to get through to it, or anybody does, I'll be doing what I can, to see, let's say, Secretary of State Powell convince the Russians and the Chinese and the French, who have relations with Saddam, to really put it to him that this game is up altogether and that he must allow UN inspectors in immediately, that he should move as fast as Khrushchev did in getting missiles out of Cuba when he saw war coming at him. And I don't think, by the way, that's the result that Bush really wants. I think Bush wants something that can only be achieved by war. He wants an invasion that will give us control of that oil under a and of the region, and that mere back down on the inspection issue would not really satisfy the Bush administration, but it could keep them from going to war and simultaneously cleanse Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, which would be a good thing in itself. So I think there is a chance of that. I'd have to say it was a small chance, but it's one I'll be working on.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We've got to wrap up now. I have one last question. In the book, Secrets, you write about meeting with Henry Kissinger in August, the fall of 1970, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
And you were interested, at this point, you have the Pentagon Papers, and you were interested in leaking into the White House.
Yes.
Here's the question I have for you. Do you think the current administration, do you think President Bush is aware of, does he have the full picture of the risks of going to war in Iraq?
I can't, this will sound as though I'm joking, I can't get a good feel for what President Bush is aware of or is not aware of into his mind. I have more confidence, without even having met them, of the way Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Pearl, these people whose judgments I certainly don't share and expectations I don't share, but they are the kind of people I worked with in the Pentagon and elsewhere. And it's not coming through to me that, on the one hand, I'm sure that they know the falsity of some of the reasons they are giving. Those can be dismissed. I do not believe they they are heading toward democracy in Iraq or would even accept democracy in Iraq, which could lead to a Shiite regime that might ally with Iran, and they wouldn't accept that. So democracy is not among our goals. I don't believe they can believe. I don't believe they can believe that Saddam is our number one danger, that they're just saying that. They can see these other dangers, I'm confident, as well as everybody else can. And do they believe that they are really going to reduce terrorism? Hard to say. A principle I learned in the Pentagon was anyone can be as dumb as he has to be to keep his job. And when you talk about these subordinates who are going down there, yeah, people can believe anything if they have to, practically. And yet, I do have trouble believing that they are that dumb, that they don't see some of these dangers. On the other hand, once you're set on a goal, there is a human tendency, right across the board, every culture and everything, to begin to turn your attention away from the costs and the risks of that goal toward the possible benefits of it, and the idea that it will work. This is why it's so essential. It would be essential for Congress to play its constitutional role of opposing their judgments, or confronting their judgments to those of these people inside who can just be, I think they've gotten swept away by the feeling of being the only superpower and the real power in the world, into a kind of arrogance and optimism that everything is going to bow down and fall before them. That's very dangerous.
We've got to wrap it up here. Mm-hmm. We've strayed a little bit past our time even.
Okay.
I want to thank you very much for talking.
Thanks for the questions, and thanks for having me.
Sure. Daniel Ellsberg has been our guest. He's the author of Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. The book is published by Viking. You can find him on the World Wide Web at www.ellsberg.net.